the moon was all aglow, and heaven was in your eyes. The night that you told me those little white lies, the stars all seemed to know that you didn't mean all those sighs. The night that you told me those little white lies.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masterson. This is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Robert McIlvaine, who is Professor of History at Millsap College. His books include The Great Depression, America 1929 to 1941, Down and Out in the Great Depression, Letters from the Forgotten Man, and The Encyclopedia of the Great Depression. In 2007, he wrote an extensive analysis of the economic conditions in comparison with those of the 1920s. If economic history doesn't repeat itself, does it rhyme? In which he predicted a coming collapse, similar to what happened in 1929. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert McIlvaine.
Glad to be with you.
And since you predicted the crash of 2008 before it happened, I'm calling upon you now to tell us whether this is our Smoot-Hawley moment, in as much as it seems like what happened recently on Capitol Hill, of course, was a travesty. But the solution, the deal, instead of reviving an economy that's distressed, seems to be at least the reaction. If today's reaction on Wall Street is related to it, then it's clearly a repudiation. But what's your sense of whether the Congress, rather than fixing the economy, help dig its grave, as Smoot-Hawley did as the Depression was starting to unravel?
Well, I don't think there's any question about it. The problem is, I did a piece in the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago talking about the contrast between fact-based economics and faith-based economics, and the faith that so many of these people have is not in a Judeo-Christian God, but in the market as a God, that it can do no wrong, and that any sort of intervention or regulation or high tax rates amount to sinfulness. And given that sort of faith, facts just don't matter. They're sort of like the people who say that God created the world 6,000 years ago, but when he did it, he put a bunch of fossils around in order to fool people and test their faith. And so if somebody believes something like that, as these people do with the market, you can plow all the facts you want up there, and they will just ignore all of them because they are all false evidence in their view. But what happened in the 1920s, basically you were talking to the previous guest about Henry Ford and the fact that you need to have people in a consumption-based economy who have enough money to consume what's being produced. In the 1920s, more and more of the income was going to the people at the very top, peaked in 1928-29, during the period in the middle of the 20th century when a substantial and fairly well-to-do middle class was built in the United States, that was not nearly as much of a percentage going to the people at the top. It's peaked again when I wrote that piece in 2007, almost exactly where it was in 1928-29, and it simply doesn't work in a consumption-based economy, whatever one may think of the morality of so much of the income going to people at the top.
So in terms of then, if there are these economic analogies, what about political analogies? Because we certainly, after 2008, we did not have Ferdinand Pecora. We didn't have any kind of investigation. The only person who called for the investigation of Wall Street was the filmmaker who won the Academy Award for the best documentary, Inside Job. Apart from that, there's been a resounding silence on Wall Street, given the massive amounts of fraud that took place. So give us your sense of the politics and why they're different.
Well, it's just mind-boggling. I mean, one of the most striking things to someone like myself as a historian of the era of the Great Depression is that both in terms of politics and in terms of economic philosophy, following the collapse of the whole laissez-faire, social Darwinist sort of approach in 1929, that was really discredited through the New Deal years, but really all the way down basically to the late 1970s and the rise of the people who supported Ronald Reagan. This time, somehow, instead of that being discredited, the people who are pushing that are basically out there saying, well, they may not admit that it's failed several times before, but basically they're saying, let's try it again. And rather than having a new deal come out of it, we've had the idea of let's go back to the halcyon days of Calvin Coolidge, or even as Karl Rove would like, William McKinley. And it's just absolutely amazing. They seem to not care that it hasn't worked before because they have faith in it. They just want to try it again.
But, you know, there are only a few billionaires in this country, and there are a lot of ordinary people. And I don't understand how, you know, the 1% have convinced the 99% that somehow protecting the interests of the billionaires is your job, and in order to do that, you have to forego health care, pensions, Social Security, etc., and education. I mean, how? In other words, back then, at least there was a political reaction when people were getting screwed. You know, yeah, Hoover was booted out, and Roosevelt came in.
Yeah, well, one of the things that's different, and I think this is important, although it certainly doesn't explain it all, is that there was a very long time between the collapse in 1929 and Roosevelt coming in fact, about 40 months, whereas between the collapse in 2008 and Obama coming in, there was about 4 months. And in some ways, that was better for the country because the stimulus, while it's ridiculed by people on the right, I believe prevented us from falling into another Great Depression in 2009. But because it was such a short time, it's been possible for the right-wing propaganda machine to somehow persuade people that, oh, this is all Obama's fault, it started under him. Nobody had any doubt that it was not Franklin Roosevelt's fault by the time he came in because it had been going on for so long. So I think that difference in the timing is part of it. But the other thing is that the Democrats, the president, and most of the rest of the Democrats have just been so miserable in presenting any sort of a message. And all the facts, sort of things that should get support from the vast majority of the people are on their side, and they just don't seem to be able to do anything with it.
So then what explains, I mean, I understand, you know, you're talking about the politicians, the failure of the Democratic representatives and the failure of this Democratic president to protect the legacy of the New Deal and to advance the standard of living of people in this country, who millions of people are being sort of arbitrarily downsized and their standard of living is being reduced because of these zealous abstract theories of libertarians and religiously based fundamentalists that you talked about earlier. They're the ones with the energy. I mean, there's not that many people in the Tea Party. In many ways, it's a manufactured fiction anyway. It's just the repackaging of the Republican right. But you have to admit it's been incredibly successful. So the idea that a tiny minority could capture the political energy of this country, and the vast majority who are getting screwed are totally supine, I don't get it.
Well, I wish I had a better answer to that. I don't get it either. Some of it has to do, I think, with long-term trends. You can even go back to Richard Nixon, and then perhaps back to the Checkers speech in 1952, when in addition to talking about his dog, he talked about how my wife Pat doesn't have a mink coat, but she does have a good Republican cloth coat. And people, Nixon, Joseph McCarthy, and others at the time, were identifying a different sort of elite, not Wall Street, against which they wanted to turn the populist anger of middle America. And they didn't succeed in doing it quite then, but as time went by, the Republican Party basically turned to becoming an anti-60s party from about 1968 on, running against what the popular perception of what the 60s was all about, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And they were able to bring a lot of people over to their side on those sorts of issues who were not really people who had anything to gain by supporting them in terms of their economic status. And so they built up this core of people who were opposed to government intervention in terms of allowing abortion or gay rights or what have you. And now, really, they've kind of lost on those issues, at least nationwide, certainly not in some sections of the country. But they've somehow managed to switch to talking about the economic issues and managed to bring those people along with them.
So what historical analogies, then, can we take from how people were motivated? I mean, I get the impression here that politics are some kind of Pavlovian process where it just has to get awfully painful for people to get off their backsides and start voting and start getting politically active and organizing. I mean, where do you think that moment will come in this country now as it did back then? Obviously, there was no social safety net in those days. People were in serious distress. Here there is a social safety net, a frayed one, that the Tea Party people and the Republicans, in collusion with the president, it seems, are starting to eviscerate.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of the problem, that the president and the Democratic Party are clearly better on most of these things than almost all the Republicans are, but not that much better. I've been saying recently that the Republican Party is a wholly owned subsidiary of corporate America, whereas the Democratic Party is perhaps a two-thirds owned subsidiary of corporate America, and so there's a difference, but they are still so close to them that it's not that they didn't accomplish anything.
Well, I'm sorry I'm getting signals here that we're running out of time, but the only point I would make is that if the far right wing of the Republicans can take over the Republican Party, how come the left can't take over this corrupt shell known as the Democratic Party? It just takes numbers and people. I thank you for joining us, Robert McElveen.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert McElveen, who's an expert on the history of the Great Depression. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began talking with he's a former Wall Street banker who covers Wall Street for Fortune, Vanity Fair, and New York Times. He wrote the book Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. And spent a decade and a half working for a couple of big Wall Street banks and has been a pretty solid journalist on Wall Street. He gave our audience, I think, a pretty good analysis of what's going on in terms of the technicalities of the 513-point loss in the Dow and all of this other stuff about how overheated the stock market is and how overvalued Facebook and all of these runaway shares, not even shares because they're privately held, but how the kind of valuation for much of what's on Wall Street doesn't make any sense. So he thought it was basically letting out a bunch of air. So I try to push him a little further because, when he starts to talk about things like Washington getting its fiscal house in order, it sounds to me like the same kind of Wall Street disconnect from reality. And he did agree, that he thought that I said, well, if it's about Wall Street, about Washington getting its fiscal house in order, maybe it's about something else. You take $2 trillion out of the economy, which is what Obama and the Republicans have agreed on, and suddenly the market crashes. It seems to me to be a vote for recognizing that these clowns in Washington, rather than stimulating the economy, are killing it in order for this abstract need to balance the budget and get rid of these deficits. So we reversed that conversation with Randall Ray, who really did lay out, I think, a very interesting story about what maybe is going on in Washington. And again, like so many people I've talked to lately, he suggested that Obama is very much, he got what he wanted. That's the scary part. That he was the first guy to get money from Wall Street before Hillary Clinton did, and he thinks that a deal was made, and that he doesn't really value the social safety net, and that is Wall Street's agenda. They don't want to compete with the rest of the world. In other words, turn Americans into Sri Lankans, which, of course, doesn't make any sense. You would think that a more educated workforce with single-payer health care would make these companies and these big corporations more competitive. After all, General Motors found that it was having to move plants to Canada because it couldn't afford health care costs here in the United States. So it's a pretty hard thing to get your head around whether it could be quite that cynical. But it's certainly a possibility that one has to entertain. Then I talked to the historian Robert McIlvaine, the author of The Great Depression, America 1929 to 41, to get a sense of whether this is our Smoot-Hawley moment where the Congress has dug the hole deeper instead of fixing the economy. They're, putting a stake through its heart. He really was, I thought, outstanding in what he had to say about, with the analogies of the Great Depression and how, you know, we're in this situation now where you really have a kind of bunch of religious nutcases on the right, the Tea Party, who really believe in this economic Darwinism and this, he actually calls it the God of the market. That's what they've, you know, it's up there with Jesus Christ. So they really believe in the God of the market and that solves all. So I asked him, you know, what's the countervailing strategy? And that's a conversation for another time. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.